the show that's focused on investing strategies for today's needs and tomorrow's goals. This is Bucket Strategy Investing, presented by the Wealth Advisors at Lucia Capital Group. Now, here are Johnny Dean and Rick the Professor Plum.
Yep, that's us, and we're ready to roll, ready to rock and or roll. We've reached the start of another hour of Bucket Strategy Investing. It's the program that gives you more of the best in money information, and all of that is just ahead. You've got a chance to get involved in the show right now. I just checked. I looked at the phones. We got three lines open. Just three. Get them now. More strategies for you coming up this hour, and we'll be taking your calls. Professor Rick Plum here with me. I'm Johnny Dean from Lucia Capital Group. If you got a money question, yeah, we got the answers for you right here. Your emails, your phone calls, all that is coming up. And we got, as I said, just a couple of lines open, three lines open right now. Give us a call if you have a question on saving, whatever it is, bucket, strategy, retirement, annuities, the real estate. We were talking about that last hour. Anything on any one of the many topics we discuss on this show, you give us a call, 877-PLANNER. That's 877-752-6637. You can also email us here in the studio. You go to our website, wealthed.com. You click on the Find Your Answer link near the top of the page. Now, we're going to take your calls in less than 60 seconds. One of the reasons we do what we do here on this program each day is our strong belief that everyone should have some kind of retirement strategy. And a good strategy is what makes your retirement work for you. It's one that fits your unique needs and goals. You give the people at Lucia Capital Group a call. They'll set you up with a bucket strategy of your own. Talk to Professor Plummer, anyone at Lucia Capital Group. Their phone number, 800-644-1150. That's the off-air number. You schedule an appointment with a brain trust advisor. You get yourself started on the right track to retirement. Again, 800-644-1150. That's the off-air number. Professor Plum here with me, 877-PLANNER, our number on the air. We're going to take some calls right now, but you want to fill these lines up because we do have room on them right now, and it can be tough to get into the program later on in the hour. 877-752-6637. Let's start with Michael in Las Vegas. Michael, thanks for hanging on. How can we help you today?
Yes, I have a question. I'm being pitched an indexed universal life policy as an alternative to like a traditional Roth for my retirement.
Okay, an alternative meaning instead of, don't do the Roth, do the life insurance. Is that what they're saying?
More or less, or if I have enough, I can keep doing the Roth, but to overfund the IUL now so it has time to compound.
Okay, how old are you, Michael?
35.
Okay, well, you're the right age group. Are you married or single?
Single.
Do you have any need for life insurance?
I do have a son, so.
Okay, so you have some need for life insurance, even though it potentially is a temporary need until he gets on his feet when he's like 30. So the question is, can you afford to fully fund your 401k at work? Do you have a 401k at work?
No, I don't.
Okay. Are you self-employed or do you work for somebody else?
Self-employed.
Okay. Can you fully, then you can have a 401k. How much income do you make? Single individual, head of household, one, is your child, your son a dependent?
Yes.
Okay. How much do you make?
Depending, but maybe right up around 100.
Okay, 100. So you could put together a retirement plan at work, you're self-employed. Do you have employees that would hinder this?
No.
So yeah, you could put a retirement plan in place where you could save, you know, $18,000 plus another 20. You could put you're probably $35,000 away on a tax deductible basis in the high tax bracket that you're in, plus do a Roth IRA. I think that's going to be a much better deal. I don't like it instead of the traditional retirement plans where you get the deductions and things of that nature. I don't like it instead of the Roth IRA, which I think is a much better deal. But if you fully funded your retirement plan options, you have lots of options, you're just not using them yet. If you fully funded your Roth IRA, you're in a high tax bracket, and you have excess cash flow that you can commit on a 10 or 15 year, specifically a 10 year basis, to put into this policy every year for at least 10 years, and you don't need the money for 15 or 20 years, then these can be a reasonable opportunity for putting together some investment, some tax-favored investments. Should it be done before you do these other things? My opinion is no. They're not that good. There is still an internal expense. There is a cost of the mortality, and there the cost of paying the agent. There's the cost of the policy. So they're not as efficient from an a tax standpoint as I believe a Roth IRA would be for you, using more traditional investments in the Roth. But they are for younger, high income, excess cash flow, people that are looking for additional avenues over and above their traditional retirement plan and Roth IRAs. They can make sense. I don't think you're there yet.
Yeah, don't there tax benefits when I start taking money out of it?
Yeah, there's tax benefits when you take the money out, but they're not that great. So you can take them. You can take your money back out tax-free because it's your money. One of the advantages of life insurance, assuming they don't do it too, as a modified endowment contract, if you stretch it out the right way, I can take out my money anytime I want, and because it's my money. It's a first-in, first-out type of taxation, unlike other assets. Roth gives you the same thing. Then once I've taken out my own money, I can borrow the cash value or a portion of the cash value out. And usually they're going to take that cash value and credit an interest rate to it that's equal to the interest rate they're charging me for the loan or very similar. It's called a wash rate loan or something like that. So I'm borrowing the money. Now the problem comes in if you take too much out too early that the policy doesn't last as long as you do. Then you have a problem. So you can't take it all out. And you know they show these wonderful growth rates, which unfortunately we just haven't seen always happening. They can. I'm not going to take it all away from you, but
how have they presented this to you? I'm just curious.
Well, a lot of it is based on the security of it, where it's indexed to the S&P, but the money's not actually in there.
That's correct.
So it has a 40% participation rate, but it has a floor of 1%. If the stock market were to go way down, I would never lose.
Yeah, with a 40% participation rate, I'm just not that excited. I mean, there are other ones out there that give you 100% participation rates with better caps. Because what is the market average? You know, 10% maybe? And so with a 40% participation rate, that means that I get 40% of whatever the market does. That means I'm going to get a 4% rate of return if the market average is 10. 4% before fees? There are expenses of the policy. They talk about how the cash value cannot go down. Well, that's not true. It can't go down because of poor market performance. That part is true. But it can go down in a year where you don't have market performance because there's very little interest, if any, being applied. And the fees internally may, you know, draw the cash value down to a point. So, you know, I 40% participation, I would run from this one. I don't like this
okay.
one. Get one with 100% participation guaranteed. I mean, I was looking at some the other day. Now, these are just the marketing brochures. I don't know the policy itself. But the caps were in the 10, 11, 12, 13% range, and the participation rate was 100%. So if the market went up 6, I got 6. If the market went up 15, I got 11 or 12. If the market went up 50, I got 11 or 12. If the market went down, I got 0. That one, I think, has a better chance than if the market goes up 15, you're only getting 6%. And how often does the market go up 15? 40% participation rate does not excite me at all.
Okay, thanks for the advice.
Okay,
but
Michael,
I still wouldn't do it until after you've done your Roth and other things.
Yeah, we should throw that in too, because you know, this is really permanent life insurance.
Cash value life insurance
is what we're talking about. And with these particular policies, I think too often they're pitched. I'm not saying this is true in Michael's case, but too often they're pitched to people who haven't done a Roth, haven't done a 401k. It's like their first line of defense
right.
from a savings standpoint.
Because that's what the person can sell. They're licensed to sell life insurance, not variable life, not investments, not securities. They're not registered investment advisors. They're not securities licensed. They can't sell anything that has a security connotation to it. So they sell these types of policies as a cure-all, be-all for everything.
Now
they're
okay.
fine for the right situation. They're not the greatest thing in the world.
What's the trade-off? You mentioned he was talking about one that was offered a 40%
participation
rate, meaning whatever this particular index does, you get 40% of that up to certain caps. What is the trade-off if you went from to 100%? I mean, there must be something that you're giving up.
Well, typically when we're seeing the participation rates, there's a combination of either participation rate, cap rate. A lot of times when you have a participation rate, there is no cap because they figure if the market goes up 40%, count on that, don't. And you've got a 40% rate, you only get a 16% rate of return. And that's a very unusual, I don't know if it's ever happened. So they're not worried about uncapping it. So when people talk about, well, I want as high a cap as possible. Well, John, I can get you a no cap policy, but you got a participation rate. They kind of say that on the side. So they can promise you almost anything. Or, you know, so there's lots of things going on. There's one that has no participation. This is an index annuity. No participation rate, or no cap rate, and 100% guaranteed participation rate.
What are you giving up?
Well, you're giving up the fact that they put it into a balanced portfolio that's 60% short duration, you know, 10% cash, and only 20 or 30% stocks, which means what are you going to earn?
Nothing.
3%, 4%?
So there's always something. So when you go, if you go from a 40% participation rate to 100%, you're going to probably give some.
Yeah, you're going to go from a cap of an unlimited cap down to a 10 or 12 cap on the life insurance. Index annuities have lower caps.
Right. Okay. Again, this is an IUL. Okay. Index Universal Life. A whole lot more to say. Maybe on this, maybe on other stuff. Whatever you want to talk about, give us a call. 877-PLANNER, our number. PLANNER. It is Bucket Strategy Investing. Okay. 877-PLANNER, PLANNER. We got some room on the phones right now. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, talking to you about your money. 877-752-6637. Don't forget, too, that coming up every Tuesday right here at, if you happen to be watching at WealthEd.com, you go to WealthEd.com, you're going to find the Social Security Show. We get a lot of questions on Social Security, and we have decided to make an entire program out of it, a half hour anyway. We've been doing this for quite a long time. I'm hosting along with Professor Rick Plum, answering your Social Security questions that you can send to us at WealthEd.com. Learn all about laws, strategies, and all that stuff. It's every Tuesday at WealthEd.com, 1 o'clock Pacific, 4 o'clock Eastern time. That's when we air it live. I think some other places may also carry it later on, but it's heard and seen live at WealthEd.com, 1 o'clock Pacific, 4 o'clock Eastern time, the Social Security Show. Learn all about Social Security, learn about strategies, and, oh, yeah, get your questions answered. Kind of convenient. WealthEd.com. A couple of emails to get to here, Professor Plum, before we get back to the calls. Lines open, I said, 877-PLANNER, PLANNER. William in Phoenix, Arizona. Why do publicly traded REITs, that is real estate investment trusts, trade at such a high multiple to book value or liquidation value? Some are trading with a PE of 30 or more, which I can understand for a tech company, but not for an owner of real estate. How does this make sense? That's William in Phoenix, Arizona.
Because people want to buy real estate and they want it to be liquid. And so they're willing to pay more for the stock of a liquid asset than they are for the underlying value of the real estate. They look at it and they say, the cash flow is 4-5%. I like that. So I'm going to pay, and a lot of people go into it. When they look at the 10-year treasury at 1.8, 1.9, and they look at the yield on a publicly traded real estate investment company at 3 or 4 or 5, they say, that's a lot better in their mind. They're equating purely yield to yield. So they start, more people buy it, more people buy it. As more people buy it, the price goes up. That's where you get a lot of increase in value on the price, not necessarily, but that doesn't mean that the underlying real estate went up in value, just the price of that stock. So why is there this difference? Because we are emotional beings, because we will pay extra for liquidity. We are crazy. That's another reason. People don't understand what they're buying, don't look at the fundamentals, and they go in and out of. I mean, this is the same reason why publicly traded real estate, as measured by one of the largest REIT indexes back in 2008, dropped more than 75% from the peak of the market to the bottom of the market in March 2009. Why did that drop 75%? Because we, as an investor population, got scared of real estate. And we sold it as quick as we could sell it. And it was just, there was a huge supply of shares on the market being sold and not very many people wanting to buy it. The price went way down. Did the underlying real estate in those trusts go down by 75% in 1 year? No. But that's not the issue. The issue is, liquidity has a way of exaggerating the volatility. We get carried away with things and we buy it way up, even though the value of the underlying security may not have gone up that far. We get afraid of it and drive it way down in price, the stock price, even though the value didn't go down that much. I remember years ago, back in the tech, just after the tech boom bust, there was a large tech company, increased revenue, increase market share, increase productivity, reduce expenses. Every fundamental metric you could deal with was in favor of this company, and the share price went down. How does that happen? They were expanding. They were more productive. They were more efficient.
Public Everything. Sentiment.
People didn't want a tech stock at that moment, and so they drove the price down. Didn't make any sense, but you know, that's the way the stock market falls.
And that's the risk you take, I guess, when you buy any asset.
And when you see these prices going up like this, it's kind of the greater fool theory. I can get in and I'll get out just before it turns around. I know that it's overpriced. It's like what we had back in the tech boom, back in the 97, 98, 99 time horizon. There's no reason for this stock to be that high, but I got to get into it because it's going to go up by X amount of percent. I'll know when to get out of it, and I won't be the last one in. Somebody obviously got hurt.
Yeah, you start seeing these things, and we're starting to see a little bit more of that in certain areas, Professor Plum, where these PEs are getting out of control. And you look at the underlying value of the company, you look at what they do, and you say there's nothing to support it. Where do we see that?
Tech boom?
I kind of remember that. That's
buying
right.
Real estate in 2006 and 7?
I go back to, you'd have companies with all kinds of price and nothing on the earnings side. I mean, nothing.
I remember back in the tech boom, looking at companies, their burn rate of cash, they had enough cash to sustain the company for about 8 or 10 months. And after that, they were going to be out of money. And under the most optimistic, just grandiose, wonderful assumptions, they wouldn't have a profit for 3 years. And people were still buying the living heck out of these
things. Yeah, and so you want to know what the definition of crazy is? That's got to be it.
That's part of it.
That's
yeah.
got to be it. Because who would buy companies? I mean, there are some that survived, but...
You also have to look at, he's talking about the P.E. ratio. Are we looking at the current P.E.? Are we looking at forward-looking P.E.? There's a lot of, especially the real estate companies that are on the development side that... have been spending money, so their PEs are down at the moment. And I'm not saying this is for across the board, but they're just coming online where they're going to be leasing up. So they haven't had a lot of revenue, and they've got another 1 million square feet of space coming on board to be leased up in the next 6 months to a year. So, right now, if you're looking just at the current
you would
price
say that's
to earnings,
crazy.
Your revenues are way down, but in the future 6 months to a year, the expectation, obviously this is a gamble, is that this space will at least lease up to some degree and create more revenue, forward-looking PE is important too.
Ordinary investors aren't looking at that, especially people who are sitting at their computer and they're just
really?
Trading this. They're going to say, well, this looks good. Hey, I heard about this particular stock over on the weekend. I heard this on a television program. Somebody said this is going to be a great buy. I mean,
and that's why ordinary investors usually screw up their portfolios.
Yeah, more often than not, they do. Where do we see that? Where somebody who just... left their portfolio alone for X number of years, and somebody who traded over and over and over, we saw that the people who traded over and over based on emotion did a whole lot worse.
Right, and we've also seen studies on the Mensa members, the people that are supposed to be really, really bright, and they tend to do worse than the average mutual fund just because they know better. Ha-ha, they know when and get in and out because they're smart. No, they don't. I mean, it's kind of a crapshoot when you're getting in and out all the time.
Because what they're doing oftentimes, what many people are doing is looking at charts. They're looking at analysis. They're looking for patterns. They're not looking into, what some of the really smart stock people are doing, which is looking at the actual companies. They're taking a step back and they're looking at
You're looking for
repeatable
good companies.
Patterns.
You're looking for good companies to hold for a while. Now, I'm not saying that you should never have somebody buy and sell stocks on your behalf, because there are times when that does make sense, other than just indexing. Indexing is fine. Some active management is fine, not the super high trading, but somebody who's looking for good quality companies, the Warren Buffett style to some degree, buy good companies and hold them for a long time. And then when they've run their course, when you buy a stock, you have to have two decisions. One is, what are you going to pay for it originally? And then the second decision is, when are you going to get out? Either a time horizon where you're not going to look at it, or a price point, high and low, that if it hits those price points, you're out. You got to have those decisions in mind when you buy it.
Yeah, a whole lot to it, and people who are just going to sit back and listen to prognosticators and folks on radio and TV shows telling you, this is the stock to buy, I love the fundamentals. All they're doing is they're looking at the same thing you're looking at online. They don't know anything about that. these companies when you call and ask about them, and that's why people tend to lose money. Okay, that becomes gambling. 877-PLANNER, got lines open right now. Fill them up. We'll take more of your calls and your emails when we come back. Bucket Strategy Investing, Johnny Dean and Professor Rick Plum. Don't go away. Welcome to the program. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum. We're talking to you about your money. 877-PLANNER, our number. P-L-A-N-N-E-R, 877-752-6637. A little bit of room on the phones. Emails, we get to more of those at wealthed.com, wealthed.com. And speaking of wealthed.com, that's where you go to sign up for one of the many workshops that we have coming up here. That's right. Still time, still room for you to sign up. A couple of different locations. The next one is going to be this Saturday. So we're going to be talking about this Saturday in Phoenix, Arizona. If you want to join the Brain Trust, you go to our website, wealthed.com, wealthed.com. Sign up March 12th. Still some room, as I said. Learn all about retirement income strategies. Meet the Brain Trust, just as importantly, this Saturday in Phoenix, Arizona. After that, Portland, Oregon happens on March 19th, a week from Saturday, and then Houston, Texas, a couple of weeks after that into April. That's April 9th, and there will be still a few more after that. WealthEd.com, our website, that'll give you all of the details right there. Tell you what it costs to get in. Nothing, absolutely nothing. There's no admission price. Just bring your money questions and get them answered at the workshop and learn about retirement income strategies. Once again, WealthEd.com. 877-PLANNER, our number, P-L-A-N-N-E-R, 877-752-6637. All right, let's get on this email roll. I've been accused of, not getting to the emails quickly enough, and I don't want that. So here we go. Padma in El Dorado Hills, California. I want to invest part of my defined benefit pension plan in real estate. I want to buy a duplex and rent it out. No mortgage, will pay cash. What are your thoughts on it? Thanks.
Well, it's a little bit easier to do in a pension plan because you're the self-trusted. You can do things, but make sure that you keep it very separate from any of your personal issues. Just keep it. The fact that it's got no mortgage is going to help from the tax accounting standpoint. You won't have any debt finance gain and those kinds of issues. But it can work. And so, like we said before, a lot of people will buy real estate inside their qualified plans because that's where the money is. Now, you will have to have certain valuations every year. It is a defined benefit plan. So there is an actuarial account calculation done every year to determine whether you're on pace to be where you need to be, how much the company needs to add to stay on pace. So this is something that it costs a little bit more from the defined benefit plan area because it's not as easily valued on a year-to-year basis. I mean, stocks and bonds are pretty easy. You can look them up online, what their values are at the moment. Real estate, you have to have an appraisal done. So it is a cost, but it's you see this quite a bit. Now, the problem comes later in life. You're going to probably want to make sure that you end up trying to sell this before you get to where you quit and you terminate the plan, or before you get to age 70 where required minimum distributions
yes.
occur. So you want it's all a matter of time horizon. If you're very close to retirement now, it makes it difficult to transfer it to an IRA because then you have issues there. Required minimum distributions, if this is the majority of your plan, then it makes it difficult depending on the cash flow. So you've just got to deal with, all the complexities down the line. But if you're 40, 45, and you're going to be working until you're 65, you got 20 years, no big deal. I mean, you see this quite often.
Yeah. Okay. So this brings up, too, and I'm glad you asked that particular question, Padma, because this brings up something that we weren't able to get into last hour because we took so many phone calls. With regard to putting real estate inside your IRA, now in this case, it's similar, I guess. You're talking about putting it inside
defined
benefit plan. But let's talk about this with your IRA. One of the some of the advantages of not putting it in your IRA, you can take depreciation. You get appreciation potentially as a capital gain. You have some deductible expenses that you can.
You get a step up in basis if you pass away.
Right. Now, if it's owned inside your IRA and you turn age 70 and a half. Well, don't all IRAs have what's called a required minimum distribution, which we talked about yesterday?
Yes, they do. And you still have to make a required minimum distribution. And as long as you have sufficient cash flow or enough other assets in your IRA to support the required minimum distribution, then it's not that big of an issue, except for How do you know what your required minimum distribution is? Well, the first thing you have to do is find out what the value of your IRA is on December 31st of each given year.
Well, how do I do that?
You've got to have your IRA valued. Now, typically, the IRA custodian does that. They look up the value of all the securities in your IRA if you've got a brokerage IRA. They look at the value of your CD if it's a bank IRA, and they issue it to, they tell the government, they tell the IRS on a form 5498, which we'll probably be getting here pretty soon. It's just information. They tell you what the IRA custodian tells the IRS what it's worth. Well, on a real estate issue, the custodian is still supposed to tell the IRS what your IRA is worth. But how do they know how much it's worth? Well, they have to value it. Now, how do they value it? They do a drive-by valuation. They do a real valuation. Somehow, they're going to value that property. So putting real estate in an IRA is not the cheapest way to do it because the IRA costs more. Yeah, it's just the way it is. Does it mean it's the worst thing in the world? Now, earlier in the show, when we were talking about putting real estate in an IRA, John mentioned the idea of putting it in a Roth IRA. Well, Roth IRA kind of gets away from that aspect because the Roth IRA that I own, for me, doesn't have a required minimum distribution. So I don't have the same issues with a Roth IRA. I don't have to worry about step-up in basis or losing step-up in basis as you would with a traditional IRA versus a personal account. Oh, tax-free with a Roth IRA if I do it right. So I'm less likely to balk at a Roth IRA owning real estate as I am a traditional IRA owning real estate.
All right, well, there are some differences between that. We didn't cover the Roth either. If you own it in a Roth, I mean, do some of those problems, as you're just sort of alluding to there, do they go away, or are there different issues with a Roth than there are with a traditional?
The biggest issue with real estate in an IRA that I've seen is people screwing it up and disallowing their entire IRA. We saw this not too long ago. We had somebody who got the property tax bill, and they just wrote a personal check for the property tax bill. They forgot that the IRA, you know, they had some other rental properties, and they just paid the property tax bill. They forgot that it was the one that was inside their IRA. Well, guess what? That's a prohibited transaction. The IRS caught it. They were going to, you know, when the IRS caught it, they disallowed the IRA. So that was a distribution of the entire IRA. That hurt from a tax standpoint.
Well, there's a penalty for that if you're underage.
Well, they were old enough. They didn't have a penalty. Okay. It was just taxable, but it was a large taxable event.
Yeah. How do you write a check out of the IRA if all you've got is the real estate in the IRA?
Well, you have other accounts. There's like, typically, you're going to have an IRA custodian.
Yes.
And the custodian's going to have a cash account. You have to have when you have rental property, you have to have a cash account. You're accepting money.
An IRA cash account.
Yeah, there's a cash account inside the IRA. You're accepting rents. So typically what's happening is you have a property manager. You put an LLC around the IRA, the real estate, and a property manager manages. They collect the rents. They write all the checks. They collect the rents. They write all the checks. They deal with everything. And whatever's left over, instead of them writing you a check for the excess, they just put it back into the IRA.
And that's where it sits and grows or does whatever it does.
And it's just in the name of the IRA. Yes.
And so you're writing checks out of that.
You're not. Hopefully the property manager is.
No, but you would hope that you have a property inside the IRA. You would hope that there is something left over, but some people, you know, they're...
Well, and that's the bigger problem, too. What if you go without... And this is where if you get too carried away,
yes,
and you put too much of it of your IRA in it, and the predictions that you had about cash flow didn't work out, and you had a tenant that left in the middle of the night. That never happens, does it? A tenant that left in the middle of the night trashed the place. That never happens. No, that does happen. And so now you have to fix it up to be able to get it rented again. But there's no cash or very little cash left in the IRA. How do you get money into the IRA? What, $5,500 a year, $6,500 a year? You can't use your wife's money to go in there, or your spouse's money, I should say, because this is all in your IRA.
Right.
You can only contribute so much money. And so it makes it somewhat difficult. So if you're going to, the moral of that story is if you're going to do real estate in your IRA, have enough other IRA sufficient cash to be able to handle things. Keep them separate. Put them in a different account if you want. But have money that you can always transfer from a separate IRA into this IRA if it's needed to be able to maintain the cash flow or the fixtures and the maintenance or the repairs on the rental property inside your account.
I wonder if people who are pushing others to have real estate in their IRA, if they're telling them all this stuff.
I don't know what they're telling them. They're also telling them it's super easy to get a loan. Well, if I've got an IRA with $200,000 in it and I want to buy a $500,000 piece of property, obviously I'm going to get a loan on it. Where are they going to? I can't sign for the loan. They can't use me, my income, my credit score as qualifying for the loan. There's an IRA that has no income, has $200,000 looking to get a loan. What bank is going to loan that one at the 3 and 4% rates that we've been seeing lately? That's not a low-risk loan. So unless you have a million-dollar IRA that can stand to, you know, that, and you're trying to buy our $300,000, okay, now you can probably get a reasonable loan because there's a lot backing it. But unfortunately,
that doesn't always happen. No. A lot of times that money is gone because it went into the real estate. Now, you have ordinary income upon distribution of the assets.
Always, yes.
Yes, out of the IRA. You lose, to me, it's one of the biggest keys to real estate, one of the biggest pros to real estate, owning it personally, is I get capital gains tax treatment.
Right, but that would be the same argument for stocks, too. In reality, I just the appreciation, I think, you know, forgoing the tax. But the thing is, with stocks, we have a little bit of taxation. With real estate, we may not even have any taxation while we're holding it.
No, exactly.
Because of the depreciation.
Right. So anyway, just some things to think about. I appreciate the email on that, Padma. 877-PLANNER is our number. We got more coming up here. More emails. Some phone lines are open, so get them while you can. Ask the Brain Trust your questions. 877-752-6637. Also, trivia and what's coming up on tomorrow's program. That's all just ahead when we come back on Bucket Strategy Investing. PLANNER, PLANNER, 877-752-6637. If you got a money question, you give us a call right now, and we'll talk to you about it. We only got a little bit of time left here in the hour, but join us anyway if you can, if you so desire. We'll also get to a couple more emails at wealthed.com, wealthed.com. Coming up on this program tomorrow, talking all about risk and things like that we were just discussing a little bit ago with Professor Plum. How about this? Managing risk in retirement. That's a big deal. Risk. What is risk besides that? What sort of risks can you be taking in retirement? Well, risks with your money, certainly. We're going to talk about all kinds of strategies that you should consider, perhaps, as far as taking care of some of the risk in your retirement portfolio. You really don't want to be out on that same limb that you were out when you were, say, 25, 30 years old. I think you know that intuitively. But we'll talk about how you can manage some of the risk in your retirement with Professor Plum coming up tomorrow. Okay, now, a trivia for today. This from the Social Security Administration. They have not sent me anything in almost a week and a half. They want to remind you that age 66 is the current full retirement age to receive unreduced retirement benefits in 2016. It was true last year, too, by the way. 43% of men, it says 2015 because that's when they sent it, 43% of men and 37% of women take their Social Security retirement benefits at their full retirement age or older.
Hey, that number's increasing. It used to be smaller number.
Well, I saw different statistics, and obviously I guess the Social Security Administration is probably a little bit more exact, where it was quite a bit fewer, that more people were taking it at an early age.
Well, and I think that had a lot to do with previous numbers, where people are now trying to work a little longer, wanting to work a little longer, and while you're working, it's very difficult for most people to get a Social Security benefit because of the retirement earnings test. So more people are working longer, and so they're starting at their full retirement age where that earnings test goes away.
Yeah, full retirement age, you can make as much as you want after you actually, in the month you actually turn your full retirement age. And that year that you turn full retirement age, there's a pretty good...
It all does depend on when you turn your full retirement age, what month. Somebody who's born towards the beginning of the year can earn a lot more money than somebody who's born at the end of the year.
Sure.
On an annualized basis.
Well, the amount is $42,000. $42,000 and change.
A little under.
Yeah, okay, a little bit under $42,000. Now they do it, if you happen to retire, say, at your age 65 or whatever, and you take your Social Security, and you did this in September or October, but you've made already, you know, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, and you start taking your Social Security, you've retired.
As long as you retire and quit earning income before you start taking your Social Security, it doesn't matter what you earned in the months before you took your Social Security. It only matters what you earned in the months when you were taking your Social Security if you're under full retirement age.
Yes. Now, they could, but will they question you because they'll say, well, wait a minute. We look back at your tax return for that year. You were taking your Social Security and you made $60,000, $70,000, $80,000. There's a way around that, right?
Well, you can choose to put the annual earnings test on a monthly earnings test only, but it's only a one-year option. You can't do it, go back to work, and then do it the next year, and then tell them that you can't use it year after year. It's a one-time, one-and-done annual election, one-time election for using the monthly option rather than the annual
election. Yeah, and I think that's probably the only time you're really going to use it, but that's a situation.
Usually it's when
where
you retire mid-year
yes,
and then start your Social Security benefits after that.
Yes, which does happen quite a bit. Okay, Lyle in San Diego, California. I'm 67. My wife is 62 and a half. I have a permanently disabled 32-year-old daughter currently receiving Social Security income. Disability was established well before she was 22. We were told that I should file for my benefits now and suspend when I'm 70. And that my wife should file for child in care spousal benefits, plus my daughter's benefits and other future actions. Is this a good recommendation?
Well, let's go with the first one. Should you file? Most likely, yes. You should file and not file. You can suspend your benefit, but I mean, we can talk about that later. Should you file? Yeah, you get have your daughter start receiving a benefit from your work record. Probably. Now, if your daughter is currently on SSI and she's receiving the maximum income from SSI, you have to look at whether or not she's going to still be able to maintain her Medicaid eligibility or whether she can get on Medicare if she gets on your benefit. So there is some trade-offs there. If she's already receiving quite a bit from SSI, it may not benefit her at all. Now, what it could potentially benefit is if she gets on a dependent adult child benefit, which is because she was disabled before 22, thank you for clarifying that, then your wife could potentially get a child in care benefit. The child in care benefit is similar to the spousal retirement benefit, but it's not reduced. It's not reduced because of her age only being 62 and a half. It would be partially reduced, though, because between what your daughter is receiving as a dependent care benefit and what your wife is receiving as a child in care benefit, the two of them combined will probably exceed the family maximum. So they may be reduced a little bit from that. But it'll probably be a lot less than what the reduction for her benefit if she starts taking it now at 62 and a half.
What is that reduction? I forget. Is it
62 and a half?
Yeah, per year it's, 6-7%?
I got to think about it now. It's a 30% reduction all the way to 62.
That's
so it's
for
probably
those 4 years.
27 and a half-ish to, which is more than your own benefit. But I mean, it's a pretty good sized reduction.
But not so,
so
much.
You just have to work the math to make sure that you're going to do it. Now, they talk about taking and suspending it at age 70. Suspending your benefit at age 70 does nothing, doesn't do you anything. Suspending until age 70 can help. But suspending at age 70, no. So maybe it was a miscommunication there. So the idea would be to file and suspend now before April 29th to at least give yourself the ability to have these other options available to you if the numbers work out in your favor. But like I mentioned before, if your daughter starts receiving too much from Social Security, maybe she has, she's not so disabled she can't work, but she has a little bit of a job. And between the job and the Social Security she's receiving makes her ineligible for the Medicaid that she's also receiving. I've seen that happen too, where you actually give up something that you thought you were going to be able to get from
because you're getting
thing.
Too much from the
Social Security and the job. You're allowed to have a certain job with SSI and still get Medicaid, so there's a give back. There's a
yes. Now SSI is different from SSDI.
Yes, she's not on. She was
right.
She sounds like she was disabled from birth or disabled at a very early age where she never worked or never paid in enough to receive a Social Security disability benefit. And so individuals of that nature are eligible once their parent goes on a benefit or unfortunately passes away. It's a disabled adult child benefit. It's very similar to what a dependent child would receive, 50% of your benefit, but it's not limited to age 18, 19.
Yep. Lyle, there's your answer. If you need more help with this stuff, or you or anybody, you can talk to Professor Plum or any of the Lucia Capital Group Brain Trust Advisors. Their off-air number, 800-644-1150. For Professor Rick Plum, I'm Johnny Dean. It's Bucket Strategy Investing.
Information presented should not be considered specific tax, legal, or investment advice. You should always seek counsel of the appropriate advisor prior to making any investment decision. All investments are subject to risk, including the loss of principal. There is no guarantee that any investing or financial planning strategy will be profitable, provide protection from loss, or meet its stated objectives. Investment advisor representatives of Lucia Capital Group are also registered representatives of and offer securities through Lucia Securities, LLC, a registered broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. John Dean is an associated person with Lucia Securities, LLC. In the information presented, Indiana, the opinions and views expressed are subject to change without notice and may not come to pass. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of skill or training.